Welcome to African American Conservative, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservative, the soul of the conservative movement.
Good evening, and welcome to African American Conservative, the soul of the conservative movement. I'm your host tonight, Marie Strotter, and with us we have Alan West and Dr. Barry Ladser. We remind our audience that these segments were pre-taped for the convenience of our guests. First up, we have Alan West. Alan West served as United States Representative representing Florida's 22nd and 18th districts. He's a 22-year veteran of the military where he earned the rank of Lieutenant Colonel as well as a Bronze Star and Meritorious Service Medal. He is a Fox News contributor, founder of AlanBWest.com, the author of the bestseller Guardian of the Republic, An American Ronin's Journey to Faith, Family, and Freedom, and the CEO of the National Center for Policy Analysis. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be back with you, Marie.
Do we see any evidence or reason for optimism that President Obama's trip to Cuba will change our relationship with that nation in a way that will benefit the United States?
The president landed in Cuba. First of all, it seems that he wasn't even invited, and there was no welcoming party or what have you for him there when he arrived. And when you think about the president shows up with all of these concessions, all of these things that he's willing to give, it goes back to the first interview that he gave in January 2009 with Al Arabiya when he made this statement toward the Iranians that if they unclench their fist, they will find a welcoming open hand. Well, this is the exact same thing that he's done with Cuba. And nothing has changed about the behavior. Nothing has changed about the violation of human rights. And for the President of the United States of America to stand on a stage during a press conference and, you know, allow his country to be denigrated and demeaned by Raul Castro talking about human rights violations, and he didn't even stand up for this country. And then, of course, we remember him doing the wave at the baseball game and everything.
Yeah.
And this is going on while the horrific Islamic terrorist attacks
in
Brussels, Belgium were occurring. So, you know, you have a president that is focused on his ideology, his campaign promises, and not about reality on the ground. And so we have just given everything, and like you say, the gift basket over to the Castro regime in Cuba, but they have not, changed their behavior whatsoever. As a matter of fact, Raul Castro, you know, explicitly stated that there would be no change in the policies or the behaviors of Cuba. And, the president basically is just going to have to get over and accept it.
One concession that may be in President Obama's Cuban gift basket is an acquiescence to their demand that we close our military prison in Guantanamo Bay, which, judging by the way things are going, may be empty by the time the president leaves office, even if it isn't closed. Anyway, you have long opposed a closed Gitmo. Why so?
Well, first and foremost, you know, these are unlawful enemy combatants. They should be removed from the battlefield if they are captured alive and not, released until the enemy, these adversaries, these non-state, non-uniform belligerents decide that they're not going to, you know, conduct operations, combat operations, war, terrorist operations against us. That has not happened. So for the president, once again, this is his gift basket to the Islamic jihadists. We're going to return these people back to the battlefield for you, such as the Taliban Five, which were basically the senior general staff of the Taliban that he released. And I think that he felt that if he could release them, then that's justification to release anyone. Guantanamo Bay has to stay. Guantanamo Bay and that facility is necessary for us to understand that we are engaged in a war against Islamic jihadism, Islamofascism, Islamism, whatever you want to call it along those lines. And as long as this dedicated enemy continues to come at us, we need to have a facility where they are taken off the battlefield. It's not about granting them rights. It's not about giving them a trial. They can stay there and die, what have you, but they're not going to be going back to the battlefield. And by the Geneva Convention, that's really all you have to do for these individuals that are truly not declared soldiers of a nation. So, I think that when you see a that again, he is beholden to a campaign promise, to an ideology, and not to the reality on the ground. And in his mind, he continues to say that this is a recruiting tool for the enemy. No, the recruiting tool is our existence, our way of life, and they're going to continue to fight against us. Guantanamo Bay should continue to exist.
A recent column by you on AllenBWest.com has made headlines because of your prediction that, quote, after Obama's embarrassing trip to Cuba, I bet he'll go to Tehran before he exits the Oval Office, end quote. Why have you made this prediction?
Well, I mean, it would be consistent with what we have seen from this president. You know, starting out back in the beginning when, like I said, he made that first interview with Al Arabiya. If you remember his speech that he gave before the Turkish General Assembly, then in April 2009, the speech that he gave before the Cairo University, where he asked for the Muslim Brotherhood members to be seated front and center. The fact that we have an administration that would thank the Iranians, as Secretary of State John Kerry did, after they held our U.S. Navy sailors on their knees at gunpoint, well, I just can't put anything past, you know, the President of the United States of America. So I think that once again, he would be looking for something to justify what he has done with Iran and to create another exhibit in his presidential library of saying that he was the first to do so. And so, you know, I wouldn't put it past him to try to reopen the embassy that we have there in Iran, and then, of course, try to go there and as a part of his, you know, extension of peace, his extending, you know, his hand, even though their fist remains unclenched. You know, there is no agreement with Iran. Iran hasn't signed anything, and from what I read, an agreement takes two parties to be signatory to it. So we keep talking about something that does not exist, and I just think, once again, the president in his very rigid ideological mind will just try to defy all sense and sensibilities and, you know, again, you know, go in supplication to, you know, the Iranian regime in the means by which he's trying to assure some type of peace.
While President Obama was watching, while President Obama was watching baseball with the Cuban dictator Raul Castro and the terror group FARC, the world was reeling from yet another terror attack in Europe, as we've discussed. Are these attacks foreshadowing attacks on U.S. soils, in your opinion, especially as President Obama continues to push for the importation of thousands of Syrian refugees?
Well, the ISIS, the Islamic State, the jihadists have said that they will seek to infiltrate these migrating people coming out of the Middle East, and that's exactly what you have seen happen. And furthermore, you have seen these enclaves or sanctuaries being established in Paris and in, you know, France and Belgium. We saw the neighborhood there. But that's no different from what is happening here in the United States of America. We saw the terrorist attack that occurred in San Bernardino where 14 Americans were killed and 21 wounded, and the response from the president was that we needed more gun control, not that we needed to, you know, toughen up on our immigration processes and procedures, especially from countries that harbor terrorist groups or countries that are listed on the terrorist watch list. You know, we need to go back and look at how we can improve our fiancé visa program, which is how Tashfeen Malik was able to get into this country, as well as our student visa program. So I think that you have a president that, you know, goes off and speaks at the Islamic Center in Baltimore and tries to castigate anyone that is speaking out against Islamofascism and Islamic jihadism as xenophobic or Islamophobic, and he's really trying to make the victims the guilty parties. And, you know, as long as you continue to dismiss this adversary, you're going to have this problem that will fester, and eventually it will come to manifestation, which, you know, unfortunately, you've seen up in the area of Minneapolis-St. Paul, where you have the Somali refugee issue of many of these single military age Muslim males that have been leaving this country to go and fight for ISIS, and they try to get back in. So we already have it happening. I mean, when the director of the FBI says that we have investigations in the majority of all the states in the United States of America with relating back to ISIS, you know, in Houston, Texas, I think it was a month and a half, almost 2 months ago, we had someone that was picked up, you know, that was well, refugee from, I believe, Iraq that wanted to conduct attacks here in the United States of America. So it's already happened. It's just a matter of when we miss it that one time and something goes boom.
Recently, President Obama suggested that the differences between socialism and capitalism are essentially negligible, stating, quote, "You should just decide what works," end quote. Is knowing that he's only months away from retiring to a million-dollar beach house in Hawaii or here in my home state of California spurring our president into showing his true philosophical colors?
Well, he's always shown his true philosophical colors, regardless of the fact that people try to dismiss it. Look, when President Obama stood up and said in 2012 in Roanoke, Virginia, that if you own a business, you didn't build that, that showed the clear delineation between understanding what the free market, free enterprise capitalist system is about, as opposed to his vision of a socialist economic model and crony capitalism. You know, the president and his acolytes, and Bernie Sanders is one of those, are the individuals that Margaret Thatcher talked about when she said one of the inherent problems with socialism is that you eventually run out of other people's money. This is about a government-centric economic model that does not respect the individual and their indomitable entrepreneurial spirit. And so for the president of the United States of America to say that the lines are blurred, and he said this in Argentina at a town hall with young people, I don't understand why he's doing a town hall with young people in Argentina. But look at what Argentina's economy used to be before they went down that path, and look how it has been completely decimated. So if you want to talk about that which has truly been best for, you know, rising people out of poverty, it has been a free market economic system, which has been able to provide goods and services, job opportunities and employment, better education opportunities to people all over the world. All the socialist economic model does is the equal sharing of misery, which is what Winston Churchill talked about.
As we speak, we are rapidly approaching what will very likely be one of the most historic political conventions of our lifetimes, although one that may turn out to be very similar to the GOP convention of 1976, which saw Gerald Ford going into it with a narrow lead over Ronald Reagan in votes and delegates. In 2016, we will likely see Donald Trump walk into the convention also with a narrow lead in votes and delegates, but unlike Gerald Ford, without the advantages of being a sitting president or even being a popular candidate among the GOP establishment. Without these advantages that President Ford enjoyed, do you believe that Mr. Trump will be able to avoid a brokered convention that many see him losing the nomination to Ted Cruz, John Kasich, or some quote-unquote fresh face? And will there be serious consequences to the GOP if he cannot?
Well, look, Marie, this is the bottom line. Everyone went into this game understanding that the rule was you got to get 1237. You get 1237, yeah, which is a majority of the delegates, then you're the nominee. Now, I like to put things in, you know, I love, you know, football, especially college football. I know you do as well. You don't get a touchdown if you make it to the two-yard line. You got to get in the end zone. And so, you know, Donald Trump and everyone, they took the field understanding that. So to say that, hey, you know, if I get to 1,200, you know, that's close enough, I should get it, I'm sorry. That's not how it works. So that means you need to have the campaign structure. You need to understand the process and system. You need to get out there and work hard and get to 1,237, not 1,235. Like I said, you don't get rewarded with the touchdown just for getting to this two-yard line. But I think the most important thing right now is everyone just needs to, you know, take a chill pill. Because you'd still have two candidates that are mathematically capable of reaching the number of 1,237 delegates, and that's Donald Trump and that's Senator Ted Cruz. We know that John Kasich does not have that possibility. I mean, he's only won one state. That was his home state. And I think it will require him to win something like 116% of the delegates. Well, that's not going to happen, of the remaining delegates. So we know why John Kasich is there. He, you know, explicitly stated so in an interview on Fox News with Bret Baier. I mean, he is there to try to, you know, prevent the others from getting to 1237 to force this to a convention where he believes the delegates will pick him, which is a completely, you know, dangerous thing because all of a sudden all of these people who have been out there, you know, voting, participating in the electoral process and the primaries and caucuses, you know, it's going to come down to, you know, a selected hand group of people that will tell them, you know, it didn't matter. That's the danger that you have in this. And, you know, I spoke up in Rhode Island at an event, this past Saturday. And I said, this has to be fully transparent, because if it is not transparent, if everyone does not understand this process, then they will feel that shenanigans and canary is going on, and it's been manipulated by the smoky room people. So that's the danger for Reince Priebus and the GOP. But for right now, you know, we got a contest coming up in Wisconsin. We got, you know, New York, California, your state. You know, so let's see if someone can make that magic number. We get to the point that everyone is mathematically eliminated from making, you know, 1,237 delegates, then we should talk about what the next course of action is.
Exactly so. Rightly or wrongly, it is the impression of many who remember your tenure as congressman that the Republican Party has difficulty supporting some of their own members. While in your case, your outspokenness and independence may have caused the party to be less supportive than some of us thought they should have been, The three remaining presidential candidates may find their own relationship with the GOP chilled for other reasons. John Kasich may have rubbed many the wrong way for staying in the race so long, as we've alluded to. Senator Cruz has infuriated many prominent Republicans for calling Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell a liar on the Senate floor. And Mr. Trump has had an unorthodox campaign that even has Trump supporter Ann Coulter comparing him to a 16-year-old who is constantly having to be bailed out of jail. Can you see the party establishment uniting behind any of these candidates or any other candidate, even if the alternative is a President Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, when you have a nominee, you have to support them. You have to get behind them. It's not about, you know, your self-interest or your special interest. It's about the interests of this constitutional republic. You know, when I look at the people that the Democrat Party are putting up, being Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, one is an avowed socialist and the other is a pathological liar who abandoned Americans to die and then lied about it. Those two choices are unacceptable if we want to continue on as a constitutional republic, if we believe in the founding principles and values of this country, our inalienable rights that come from the creator of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. What Bernie Sanders is offering has never been successful anywhere in the world. So why would we even think that here in the greatest economic engine the world has ever known that it would be, you know, possible? Hillary Clinton, well, you know, most of us folks in the military, we had done a fifth of what she had has you know, quote unquote, been, you know, investigated of doing. We'd be doing a perp walk in Fort Leavenworth. So, you know, how do you have a person like that as commander in chief? So I think that you know, whoever it is, you unite behind them, you make them the best and the strongest nominee, you put a team behind them that regardless of the individual, you have a team of people that is talking about, you know, economic growth, better opportunities through quality education and prosperity, and then also keeping us safe and secure. Because, you know, we're scheduled to be $20 trillion in debt by the time President Obama leaves. We're getting close to a red line moment. Our deficits are supposed to start right back increasing and getting back up to, you know, $1 trillion deficits by 2020. So we need someone that will go in, talk about budgetary reform, spending reform, tax reform, regulatory reform, and monetary reform, you know, so that we can inspire the next generation of great economic development in America and opportunities for our citizens. But they also have got to do the number one thing that the federal government is responsible for, and that's to provide for the common defense.
Just as the Republican community as a whole has been divided during this primary, so too has the African-American conservative community. The National Black Republican Association and Dr. Ben Carson have endorsed Donald Trump, for example, while others, such as we here at African-American Conservatives and the Black Conservative Fund, have favored Senator Cruz. However, both campaigns have been criticized by how little they are doing to attack the black vote, which is surprising when one considers that many commentators have mentioned that if Republicans could revert the black vote back to pre-Obama levels, it could eliminate many of the current Democratic electoral advantages. Is the African-American vote once again being ignored by the GOP?
I got to tell you, that's what I see, Marie. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Where's the counter message to Black Lives Matter? Where's the counter message to all the failures that you see in every single major urban center that is under Democrat control? When you see the breakdown of the family, when you see the lack of better quality education opportunities, when you see the lack of small business entrepreneurship and growth, that's what people should be going into these communities talking about. And this is the reason why. Because in 2012, Barack Obama won, I think, like 27% of the counties in the United States of America. But 27% of the counties gave him close to 330 electoral college votes. So they have a playbook, because those 27% of the counties are centered around urban centers. So you have a liberal, progressive, socialist left that knows exactly what county to go into, what precincts to go into, and they're all surrounded and based upon, you know, the urban environment, the cities. And that's where you see the greatest loss negative effect of their policy, the failure of their policies. And no one is talking about that. And I get very frustrated with these campaigns that are sitting out and going to, you know, the same old well and talking about the things that, you know, they seem to be comfortable with, or they're talking about foolish things, you know, each other's wives, instead of really talking about the issues and going down and saying, you know, here is the reason why, you know, the Black community went from 77% two-parent household to 24% two-parent household. And it started with Lyndon Johnson, his Great Society programs. And look at what has happened in the Black community. Look at what has happened. You know, we're the ones that want to talk about school choice, school vouchers, charter schools, you know, you having the choice. We want to talk to you about education savings accounts. Not these people that want to keep you trapped and fail in public schools because they're, you know, slaves to the National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers. You know, we're the ones that want to talk about how we can open up more small business entrepreneurship and how we can open up capital to flow back in and how we will work with the police officers and make sure that you have a safe environment so that those businesses can grow and thrive and hire people within the communities. Who was the last candidate you heard talk about those things in this election cycle? Hello? Hello?
Sorry, I had a coughing fit. I'm back. I'm good.
Okay.
We have learned from your organization, the National Center for Policy Analysis, that Senator Ted Cruz has introduced a bill called the Educational Freedom Accounts Act, which would, quote, create a universal private choice program in Washington, D.C., for every public school student, including those enrolled in public charter schools, end quote. You also wrote, quote, give parents all forms of school choice and let them decide what works for their child. School choice promotes better economic growth and increased opportunity and is in keeping with the promise of the American dream, end quote, as we've just discussed. How important an issue should school choice be in the upcoming campaign, particularly against a school choice opponent in Hillary Clinton?
It's incredibly important, and I speak – you know, as the result of two parents in the inner city of Atlanta, Georgia, who made a choice for me in my education. You know, instead of me going to the same old public school in the community, you know, they were able to save up the money, and they sent me to Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic School, located right across the street from Martin Luther King Jr.'s Ebenezer Baptist Church. And so I had an incredible education, an incredible foundation that, you know, got me on the path to where I am today. Now, I finished up at Henry Grady High School, which was a public high school, in the years, the 10th through the 12th years. But prior to that, my 9 years of going to, you know, private Catholic schools gave me an incredible advantage, you know, going in and set the conditions for me to be successful. Same what we have done, my wife, Dr. Angela West, and I, with our two daughters, Aubrey and Austin. So parents are the ones who should be in charge of educating their child. And what I find so interesting is that the only time the left wants to talk about choice is when it's about killing children,
That's
killing
right.
babies. Okay, but
That's
when it
right.
comes to choice for educating kids, they don't want to talk about that. You know, you don't have that right. And so if you want to talk about the most important thing, the greatest equalizer, you know, for a child is a good quality education, and the parents should make that decision, not some politician, not some folks that are tied to unions and their contributions, but the parents should have the freedom to be able to make that decision, because a better educated electorate is not dependent upon the government. So really the bottom line we're talking about is do we want folks that are independent, or do we want folks that are dependent? And I will tell you that if you look at the progressive socialist left, I think they want the latter, not the former.
And I think it goes back to the point we were discussing earlier in terms of messaging to minority communities. This is the perfect issue to coalesce behind. What parent is going to say that they don't want better educational options for their child? This
None.
Is a perfect, yes, it's a perfect issue. And again, the messaging just isn't there.
No, it's not there, and, you know, I don't know who are the policy directors for these respective campaigns, but I will tell you that I would give them an F right now because they're not talking about these things. And so that's why you see this morass that we have on the GOP side. Like I say, I totally discount, you know, the Democrat side. Neither one of them are viable, and in my mind frame, they're not eligible to truly be a commander-in-chief or president of the United States of America based upon, you know, the things that they stand for, what they represent, and what they have said. But we have an incredible opportunity to shape a conversation in the United States of America, get back to constitutional conservatism, get back to talking about, you know, how we want the individual to be sovereign and preeminent, and not this collective subject. Subjugation, which is what I see happening under this current president.
You suggested on Alan B. West that Hillary Clinton may have to name Bernie Sanders as her running mate in order to save the Democrats' chance of winning the presidency. Can a Trump-Cruz ticket do likewise for the Republicans?
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't know if the Trump-Cruz relationship is salvageable.
Yeah.
I mean, they have, you know, like two battleships during World War II. They just shot so many shells into each other's broadside. But if Bernie Sanders continues to win states and primaries and caucuses, he is a very viable entity. And there is that voice out there that cannot be disenfranchised. So, you know, the uber left, which controls the Democrat Party now, they don't trust Hillary Clinton, you know, and the problems that she has when you look at the issues of you know, Wall Street financing and all of these things that, you know, the Democrats say they're against, and they blame the Republicans, you know, for being in bed with. Well, their eventual nominee could be that type of person. So if Hillary Clinton is not, you know, indicted, which means that, you know, the president would probably try to prop up Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, you can't dismiss Bernie Sanders. I mean, right now he has won, I believe, the last 6 of 7 electoral contests on the Democrat side. You can't just, you know, throw him away. So and then the other little thing, the political elitism that comes in on the Democrat side are these superdelegates. And so when people start to realize that the game was already cooked and rigged, as Bernie Sanders says, then they've got a little internecting issue that they're going to have to deal with on the Democrat side.
That's absolutely right. If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been Alan West. What's next for you, and how can we continue to follow your work?
Well, what's next coming up for me will be on Sunday, the 10th of April at George Washington University at 3 p.m. I will be in a debate forum against former White House spokesperson Jay Carney. It is being sponsored by the Young Americas Foundation and the George Washington University Campus Republicans. So, you know, tune into that. I'm sure it will be on the Young Americas Foundation website. But I will continue to, you know, stand up and fight for this great republic. Please visit our website, ncpa.org, where I am now the executive director. So that really frees me up to get out and do a lot of great work and you know, taking this message all across the country. And sign our Provide for the Common Defense petition, because we have got to get our defense structure and national security back to the state that it needs to be in. And, of course, as Marie always lets you know, you can follow me personally at www.alanbwest.com.
Excellent. As always, thank you for everything that you do.
My pleasure.
And that was Alan West. Next up, we have Dr. Barry Lotzer discussing crime in the United States. Dr. Barry Latzer is the Emeritus Professor of Criminal Justice at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the author of many books on the death penalty and the state constitutional criminal procedure. His latest book is entitled The Rise and Fall of Violent Crime in America. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marie. Glad to be with you.
You write in the preface to The Rise and Fall of Violent Crime in America that the goal of your book was to fill the gap of scholarly literature that provides a, quote, comprehensive history of violent crime in the United States over the last six decades of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st, end quote. What inspired you to accept such a formidable challenge?
It was pretty daunting, Marie. I felt that it hadn't been covered comprehensively. Crime in my lifetime was one of the most serious problems facing this country, and I felt that to do it justice, one had to take a longer view of things and not just a one-year or two-year slice. So that's why I took this on.
Although it does acknowledge possible global explanations for a rise in crime rates, as the title makes clear, your book deals specifically with violent crime in America. But the reader may be curious what it is about our violent crime that is unique from the violent crime we see internationally, ranging from a country like Iceland, where violent crime is almost non-existent, to a nation like Honduras, which has a murder rate more than double that of the most violent city in America. What distinguishes American crime from that of our peers, in your view, and what might we learn from their experience?
Well, my theory is that different cultures, and this includes subcultures within a country, do different amounts of violence. And remember, I'm focusing on violent crime, so theft, for instance, would not be within that definition. And what I found with respect, say, to murders, if we compare our rates to the rates in Europe, we find that if we look at homicides with firearms, our rates are extremely high compared to European countries that are like ours because they are advanced democracies with industrial economies, and so they're quite similar to our country. And yet, when I compare their other violent crime rates, let's say a robbery or rape or assault, the rates were quite comparable to ours. For instance, we had in 2012 113 robberies for every 100,000 people. In England, the rate was 108. In France, 173, higher than ours. And in Germany, 60 per 100,000, which is much lower than ours. So the rates of violent crime in general are comparable to ours in European countries, but the firearm homicide rate is much higher in our country.
Interestingly, although America suffered greatly during both World War II and the Vietnam War, and both saw the conscription of many young males into military service, these two war periods were extremely different in a number of ways, including their impact on society. Would you tell us how each war and their aftermath affected civilian crime rates?
Well, it's very interesting. In World War II, we were still in a crime trough, a crime low period. And I say still because that crime trough actually began during the midpoint of the Great Depression. Around 1934, crime began to sink, and it remained low in the 40s. Why did it remain low? Because when you conscript young males, since young males do the preponderance of violent crime, that helps reduce violent crime rates in a country. Now, working in the other direction, you had a lot of migration within the country, especially in the 40s. You had people going to cities in order to work in factories where they were producing war material. You had people migrating to coastal cities to help build the ships used in the war, mainly in the Pacific. So you had an enormous migration within this country, and that actually accelerated crime a bit because the cities that hosted these migrants weren't prepared for such an influx, and the housing conditions and conditions for teenagers and younger people were pretty rough. So these were cross currents. They worked in different directions, but overall crime went down because the conscription had a massive impact. The 60s and the Vietnam War, a very different era, and we can get into that if you want to take more time, and I'll leave that up to you here.
Let's discuss that, please.
Well, the 60s, of course, had so many other things going on, not just the war. In the 40s, the war really dominated everything. Everything was about the war, and everything else, all other social issues, took second place. Not true in the 60s. The 60s was a period of turmoil, and many positive things came out of it. I would consider certainly the civil rights movement, which came out of the 60s, was a positive development. But on the other hand, you had the protests, you had the sometimes violent protests in the streets, you had riots in the black communities in the late 1960s, and of course you had the controversy surrounding the Vietnam War. So you had so many different cross currents in the late 60s. Some people think the social turmoil itself reduced inhibitions to crime because they reduced the values that people hold when they adhere to the criminal laws. I'm not as sure about that as some other writers. I think there were other factors involved. But certainly the crime in that period began to climb exponentially, I'm talking about the late 60s, even though there was a war going on, or maybe because of it.
Mm-hmm. The causal relationship between violent crime and poverty has been frequently debated by criminologists, as some will point to the low crime rates in the impoverished Appalachia as evidence that the relationship either does not exist or that the relationship has at least been exaggerated. You say, quote, the movement of certain subcultural groups to the middle class may have contributed to a reduction in their crime levels, end quote, which suggests that you support the view of a direct relationship between poverty and violent crime rates. But you also point to, quote, the overwhelmingly non-pecuniary motivation of violent crime, end quote. Would you mind clarifying your position between the relationship between violent crime and poverty?
Yes. My position is this. There definitely is a relationship between being poor and committing violent crime. Violent crime is overwhelmingly committed by poor people. But and for me, this is a big point. This is where I differ from most analysts. There are big differences in rates of violence among impoverished groups or groups that are have low incomes. In other words, you could take two different groups, both impoverished, both, say, discriminated against, both living in bad housing conditions, both being abused and mistreated by authorities, and one group will have much higher violent crime rates than the other group. So poverty alone is not a good explanation. It's not a sufficient explanation. The philosophers sometimes say you can have a necessary but not a sufficient explanation, and I think poverty really falls into that category. So what it differentiates these poor groups from one another? Why do some poor groups commit more violent crime than others? And here's where I say you have a cultural issue where some groups of people use violence to resolve interpersonal conflict much more than other groups of people. And this, I think, is at the root of a violent crime, not poverty alone. And I can give examples if you want to take the time for that.
Sure.
Here's a vivid example that I have in my book, Marie. Miami in 1980s. In Miami in the 80s, you had a big influx of, as they called them then, boat people from Haiti. These were very poor Haitians who were fleeing turmoil on their island and entering the United States illegally. And they ended up in Miami. Now, these people were black. They had very little English. They had very low levels of job skills that were marketable in the U.S. economy. They were unwelcome and unwanted. And I compared their violent crime rates to the rates of African Americans who lived in Miami at the time. And I found that the African American rates were much, much higher than the rates of these Haitian immigrants. So I ask, why would that be, since both groups are black, both groups would be discriminated against, and if anything, the Haitians had more social disadvantages than the resident African-American population. So there must have been something with the Haitian population that discouraged them from committing crime. Now, certainly it's possible that because they were illegal entrants into the United States, illegal immigrants into the United States, that they were afraid of being caught, and this discouraged crime. But I think there were additional factors involved, maybe something to do with their religious nature, maybe something to do with their families. There were some other factors, cultural factors I call them, that discouraged violence among the Haitian population, even though, as I say, their adversities were greater than the African-American population.
Judging by the headlines that continue to scream at readers today, much as it did during the days of the Rosewood Massacre a century ago, few things inflame the passions of Americans more than intra-racial violent crime, particularly black-on-white violence. According to the most recent statistics published on the matter by the Manhattan Institute, while black-on-white violent crime occurs more frequently than white-on-black crime, the numbers are not completely dissimilar, as blacks are responsible for 13.7% of the violent crimes against whites, and whites are responsible for 10.4% of the violent crime against blacks. Yet, quote, black thug, end quote, headlines continue to be reiterated to great effect. Do you agree that the perception of intraracial violence is greater than the reality of it? And if so, what has been the consequence of this perception?
Well, for homicides, for murders, the crime is very highly intra-racial and intra-ethnic. In other words, you don't have much black-on-white crime when it comes to homicides. Where you do find more black-on-white crime is with something like robbery. Now, why is that so? This is because robbery is a crime committed against strangers, whereas homicides are often committed against family members, neighbors, friends, and acquaintances. So since groups tend to associate more with their own kind, as we used to say, you have more interaction between African Americans and other African Americans, naturally. And therefore, since homicide is often a matter of family or friends or relatives or neighbors, you get much more black-on-black crime than you would black-on-white crime or white-on-black crime. When it comes to robbery, it's a different story. Now, that, too, is very interesting, though, Marie, because if you look at the period from, say, the end of the 19th century, which is the time when African-American violent crime rates started to get higher, and you look at the victims of that crime, and you look from the late 19th century, let's say, right up to the 1950s, you'll find that the victims were almost all black. and this was true not only for homicides, but for robberies and assaults and all other violent crimes as well. This reflected, of course, the extremes of residential segregation in the United States, so that interactions between whites and blacks was limited, and therefore the interaction of a criminal nature between blacks and whites was also limited. Now, this changed when? In the 1960s, because in the 1960s, you had an acceleration of the Great Migration to the North, and you had much more interaction between whites and blacks, and therefore you had a much greater increase crime interactions between whites and blacks. And I would argue that this had a harmful effect actually on civil rights, because it reinforced racist prejudices against African Americans. And this is rarely discussed, but I have data in my book to demonstrate this situation. Now, as for the current day, well, of course, we have a lot of discussion now of abuses of African Americans by police, and that is obviously an issue of concern. But I don't think there's any evidence of a systematic mistreatment of African Americans by police. So I believe that the media does tend to exaggerate this situation, and it does tend to cause dissension and divisions between the races. I think when these cases occur, I think each one needs to be examined on its own merits, so that when we have a clear racially motivated crimes is really what you have to call them, the police have to be prosecuted and treated accordingly. And when we don't have that, just because it's white on black, we shouldn't assume that it's racially motivated. It's more, these situations are more complicated than that. So, yes, we do have a white on black crime situation, mainly with robbery, but for homicide, it's still overwhelmingly black on black or white on white.
You write, quote, "Black homicide rates have been at least seven times the rate for whites over the last, for the entire 20th century and into the 21st. Can we explain this without the tying of racism? The answer is yes," end quote. How then should this be done?
So this is another one of those very sensitive issues, but I discuss it because I think it's a part of our social reality, and I think it's better to address these things than to pretend that they don't exist. The data are pretty clear. They're in fact quite overwhelming. You have very high rates of homicide, criminal homicide, within poor African American communities. And this has been so since the late 19th century. Now, some racists will take comfort from that and say, and they won't say it publicly anymore because, fortunately, this kind of talk is totally frowned upon and repudiated in contemporary society. But I think we need to have this discussion, and I think we need to have it honestly and candidly without any racist theories, which no one, and certainly I, do not accept. And so how can we do that? The answer, I think, is historically. If we look at the genesis, at the start of the high rates of African-American violent crime, we'll find that the 1880s and the 1890s are the key period. And it's not entirely happenstance that that was one of the most difficult and frustrating periods for African Americans. This, of course, is commonly known as the Jim Crow era, a period in which the civil rights laws that had been passed during Reconstruction were all rejected and repudiated and repealed, when we had high rates of lynchings of African Americans, extremely high, and when laws imposing segregation were established throughout the South and also even in the North, where there was a much smaller African-American population, of course. So when we look back at this period, this is the period when violent crime rates, and it was almost all black-on-black, I should add, when violent crime rates began to accelerate and spike within the poor African-American community. And so why is this? In part, it's, of course, out of frustration, I think, over Jim Crow. In part, it's because, and I think this is the major piece of it, in the South, whites had always engaged in lots of violence when there were interpersonal conflicts. This was a hallmark, actually, of white Southerners going back to the 18th century. And I think because 90% of the black population comes out of the South, I think African Americans essentially adopted this approach, if you will, this cultural manifestation, this way of handling interpersonal conflict. So we see among African Americans, as often among whites, disputes that turn violent over purely petty matters, card games, sometimes sexual matters, fights between men over women, long-running feuds between individuals, and these kinds of conflicts lead to violence. So I believe that the Southern environment, so to speak, the white Southern proclivity to using interpersonal violence, the availability of guns. Guns were very cheap back then. I went into the Sears catalog, one can get these things nowadays online, and I found the Sears catalog from 1897. And Marie, I saw that you could buy a handgun for $2.50 out of the Sears catalog, which even then was pretty cheap. So you have Jim Crow and the frustrations and anger over that, you have the Southern culture of interpersonal violence, and you have the ready availability of handguns, and this is really the time when African-American violent crime spikes. And by the way, I'm not the only one who noticed it. I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with the name W.E.B. Du Bois, who was one of the great, pardon me, who was one of the great figures in African-American intellectual history and one of the leading sociologists of his day. And Du Bois wrote a book in 1898 called The Philadelphia Negro, in which he discusses quite candidly the high rates of violent crime among African-Americans. And he even formed a conference in Atlanta in 1906 to address this problem. That's how seriously Du Bois took the issue. So I would say we could avoid the tinge of racism, we can avoid the charge of racism, and have a rational discussion of this very real issue, and should have this discussion. We shouldn't just pretend it doesn't exist and that it'll just go away.
One current theme that has been a favorite on the political campaign trail has been the high rate of African-American incarceration. According to Bernie Sanders, for example, quote, a black male baby born today, if we do not change the system, stands a 1 in 3 chance of ending up in jail, end quote. While this is, quote, an unspeakable tragedy, end quote, in Sanders' view, you argue that these incarcerations, quote, positively affected African Americans and their communities much more than they did white communities, end quote. Why so?
Well, of course, if you live in a community where there's a tremendous amount of violent crime and you are law-abiding, or even if you're not law-abiding, it's a pretty frightening thing. Those people who can move out of those communities do so. So the argument would be quite simply, if this kind of violent crime can be controlled, if we can lock up and protect communities from violent predators, that's a good thing. that improves the community. But the reality, of course, is more complicated than that. No one wants their sons and their brothers and their family members harassed and locked up by the police, even though some other objective observers may say, well, they deserved it because they were involved with crime. So at the same time, you get resentment of the aggressive policing in these communities. And that resentment, of course, becomes manifest in protests against the police. But Mr. Sanders should know that it won't be so easy to resolve these criminal justice problems. More than half of all prisoners, Marie, are in for violent crimes. So if you have a group of people that do high rates of violent crimes, they're going to have high imprisonment rates. And this is almost unavoidable unless someone comes up with another way of dealing with violent offenders. And no one has come up with another way of dealing with violent offenders. So, for instance, if we look at all prison inmates and look at the kinds of crimes that they're imprisoned for, we find 54%, these are 2013 figures, we don't have much later than that, 54% were sentenced for violent crime. And this is 57% of all black inmates, and I should add 48% of white inmates. So when you have high rates of violence in a community, whatever the community is, you're going to have high rates of incarceration of members of that community. And quite frankly, I think most of that is unavoidable. I don't see any way around that unless someone comes up with a better way of handling violent offenders.
We're also hearing from the presidential candidates warnings about the connection between illegal immigration and crime, as one candidate in particular has received a wee bit of attention by claiming, quote, the worst elements in Mexico are being pushed into the United States by the Mexican government, end quote. While some claimed that this sentiment was racist and or inaccurate, you actually looked into a possible correlation between.
Thank you for joining African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Please join us at www.AfricanAmericanConservatives.com. There you'll find information about our Twitter feed, Facebook page, and our blog. All opinions expressed here are those of this show and our guests. Copyright African American Conservatives.